Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Queer Quadrant, a podcast where we, two bisexual filmmakers, examine cinema in all its cultural contexts and explore why your favorite four-quadrant blockbuster is maybe not as straight as you think it is.
Just a question for you. Okay. Has a movie ever been simultaneously so good and also maybe so bad?
But it's not so bad is the thing.
But is it?
I don't know. I know you like this movie,
So I watched this last year for the first time with my roommate. And then I watched it this year alone. And both times had the time of my life, you know, was living. It was great.
So I don't know what you're complaining about.
But then like the last, I wonder if I have an issue maybe with the ending. If I want, I don't know if it's like the ending, but it like leaves me a little, because it's, I feel like such a wild roller coaster for so much of it. And it's maybe because I don't buy Ryan as an actor necessarily, as like a talent.
Oh, we have a lot of things that we need to dig into.
I see some shocked faces.
You just said.
I'm just going to get all of my things out here. And then my other hot take is, I almost wonder if the sexual chemistry between Ryan and Sarah Michelle is better than Ryan and Reese, which is shocking because Ryan and Reese went to get married and have kids.
This is okay.
I'm throwing everything out there. It's now there. I'm going to leave the podcast. This has been a great time, everybody. I will see you in the next episode.
I was ready for us to, like, you know, have our little discussion before we do formal intros, but like this needs to be addressed.
I had to just say it.
We need to
It's been on my brain for a year and a half.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Brooke Solomon.
Should we do it in like a upper class, like New York slang? Like, oh, I'm Brooke. No.
That's British, but nice try.
What's like a...
I mean, I have my
a hoity-toity?
Hi, I'm Brooke Solomon.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, that's good. I'm Jordan Gustafson.
And joining us today are Trace Thurman and Joe Lipsett. Horror queers, thank you so much for being here. You're being very polite and not speaking until introduced.
Thank you for having us. No, honestly, it was just like the word, you're like, I don't know if it's good or bad. I was like, no, it's melodramatic.
Yes.
It's not bad. That's not a good bad point.
Yes.
I mean, Jordan calls everything under the sun camp, and this is like a great example of something that is camp.
This is camp.
I don't know if I would call this camp. And it's so, because
huzzah!
No, I know. Because no, Joe and I talk about camp all the time. I'm just, I don't know. It's vulgar. It is very melodramatic. I don't know if I would call it camp. But
oh my God, the opening scene alone with the therapist, and she's banging on the glass, and he's just like, "Oh, I'm just gonna pick this chick up for lunch." And Tara Reid's crying her face off.
I guess
the computer says, "You're a slut. You're a slut." Like, it's pure camp.
Nevertheless, incredible. Though, I will say, in every iteration of this story, because it's based on like a 1782 novel, which became a play, which became like four different movies. Like, the relationship between the Valmont character and the Annette character is always the least interesting part of the story.
So I
don't know. I mean, like, I do like.
So Reese with am the I right?
I mean, but I don't think it's the fault of the actors. I think it's the roles themselves.
No, totally. I just think that, like, inherently, I don't, like, look, this is what you get for trying to hook up with your half-sibling is getting me Joe Blacked, like, for sure deserved. But, like, I am way more invested, weirdly, in the Sarah Michelle Ryan business going on.
Absolutely.
Because I'm like,
I think you're meant to be.
Yeah, right. For sure.
Yes,
because the problem is that the Annette character is fucking boring.
Yes.
Like,
that's the thing. She's boring protagonist syndrome, except she's not even the protagonist.
Right.
Well,
right.
I will tell you this. So I did like way more homework than I needed to for this episode. So I went back and I watched Dangerous Liaisons, which is the 1988 movie.
Yes.
That's like where Glenn Close is the Sarah Michelle Gellar character. Michelle Pfeiffer is the Reese Witherspoon character. Perfect movie.
Queen.
It's fantastic. Like, it's basically Cruel Intentions, but like in 18th century France. It's awesome. But I also watched a movie I'd never seen before called Valmont, and it came out in 1989, and it stars Annette Bening in the Sarah Michelle Gellar role, and Colin Firth in the Ryan Phillippe role, and Meg Tilly in the Reese Witherspoon role, and Fairuza Balk in the Selma Blair role as a 14-year-old girl, by the way.
Oh my God.
But here's the thing. It does make the Sarah Michelle Gellar character, Myrtoil, the focus. Like, she is the protagonist of that film, and I would argue that the film is less than because of it.
Yes.
Now, granted, that film takes an approach to, like, humanize the character a bit because she's the protagonist of the film, doesn't work. But it's one of those things where you're like, oh, like, the story doesn't work if you put the Valmont Annette stuff further on the back burner.
Right.
So,
because you need, like, that weird push and pull where it's like it is, like, the very basic, like, straight people falling in love, and it's sort of like this return to purity away from like, you know, the horrible, like, twisted step sibling relationship, which is by nature much more fun. I mean, if it's not clear, today we're talking about 1999's Cruel Intentions, a cultural moment, a defining film. I'm so glad this is the movie that you picked. I love
the minute
this
we
movie.
Saw the list, we're looking through it, we're like, oh, there's a lot of Cruel Intentions.
Cruel Intentions.
What is our, like, what is your respective relationship with it? Like, when did you first see it? How did you come to this movie, this moment?
Yes.
This moment. Oh, God. So this is definitely during a peak period when I was going to the movies all the fucking time. So I was very much like a child of the 90s. So post-Scream, I saw pretty much any film that was starring someone who had a TV show on like the WB. And obviously I was watching Buffy. So the minute that I see Sarah Michelle Gellar and then heartthrob Brian Philippe in this movie, I'm like, well, I'm obviously there opening weekend. And I loved it then. I've loved it every time I've watched it since. It, I do think I've gotten a little bit more critical of its queer depiction this go around, even though I do recognize that it is being campy and it's taking the piss out of absolutely everybody. So it's hard to take that critique too personally, but like, I still love it. This is like a 4.5 out of 5.
I'm definitely excited because I mean, rewatching this, I hearing the F slur, I was like, oh right, I forgot they just dropped that like, constantly. But
comes
it's definitely
real
a case
quick.
But it's also a case where it's like, I mean, again, Joe and I talk about this a lot, where it's like, well, if the character says it, does it mean the movie says it? Like, kind of a thing.
Right.
And in this movie, I don't think so because it's very much these are like rich, preppy, asshole white kids. I definitely saw this movie on TV the first time because there's not, you know, there's no gore, there's no actual, like, sex in it. Even the sex scene itself is kind of, like, chaste.
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm.
Comparatively speaking to the dialogue, which is not at all.
That's where it gets the R rating.
Yeah, 100%.
The dialogue is just full throttle.
Which is, it's kind of the best way to be. Yeah.
Absolutely. But honestly, it's one of those things where it's like, even watching this movie today, it's like, this, there's something taboo. That it feels taboo about this film, where it's like, I feel like I shouldn't be watching these children. And granted, you know, the age of the actors range from 20 to 27. But, like, so I watched this on TV a lot, and I never got to watch the R-rated cut until I was probably in high school. And I watched it, and I think this is a movie that I watched, like, once a month.
All the time.
At least. Yeah. But it's because I was like, oh my god, I feel like I shouldn't be watching this, so I want to consume it as many times as possible to have it burned into my brain.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, this movie, honestly, like, I mean, also try watching it with your grandmother, which I absolutely did.
Oh my god! I cannot even imagine. Like, I don't think anyone else in my family is aware of this movie. I hope that they never become aware of this movie. I don't remember.
You need to go home for the holidays and watch this with your family.
Guys,
I need to
record
their reactions.
We're throwing on Cruel Intentions.
So I know Jordan, like, you saw it the first time last year. Have you seen it before this?
Yes. Don't remember what originally motivated me to watch it, but it was like sometime in college. Yes, for sure.
We're cruel.
Cruel Intentions. Yeah.
It was sometime in college and I was like, oh, I have to watch this thing. And I like, it was before I like really understood like what this era of like film was trying to do. Like I hadn't seen like I Know What You Did Last Summer or like anything that was Jawbreaker, like anything that was kind of like in that camp. Mm-hmm. So
it's an interesting mix. I mean, cause like, so yeah, I think where Joa had the Buffy connection, I definitely had the I Know What You Did Last Summer connection because I was like watching that a lot on TBS. Cause again, I couldn't watch the DVD, but it was also like, yeah, it's mixing that with like, again, like that wave of teen comedies adapting classic literature, you know, like Clueless, She's All That.
10 Things I Hate About You, kind of.
10 Things I Hate About You. Yeah, I mean, again, you're taking a classic literature and you're putting it in a teen movie. This is just the one that went, like, taboo. Really full R-rated, which honestly matches the source material anyway, like tonally speaking.
I mean, yeah. I don't think a PG like even though you had seen a PG version of this, like I don't think a PG version works. Like you need the dialogue, you need like it to have that bite to it. Otherwise, it becomes the Reese Witherspoon version of the movie where you're like, oh, it's like this sweet little Alabama girl versus like this New York, you know, you hate everybody in the movie, but you can't stop watching them, where you're like, I love this.
I mean, the PG-13 version of this is basically Gossip Girl.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. And you can see so much of the genesis of that. Like, the Gossip Girl books, I think, were already in production by the time that this film came out. But especially, like, I don't know if you folks have watched the reincarnation of Gossip Girl, where it's so desperate to be edgy, and it's like, oh my god, we're doing cunnilingus in a bar, and you're like, yeah, you know what? Go back and watch Sarah Michelle Gellar do like a blow in the public bathroom. It's
with her, been with here before, her cross. Folks.
Yes.
With the cross. Oh my God. I remember vividly. So this was my last year of high school. And there were girls who were so obsessed with this that they were like, can I just get a model cross that has like the Coke thing? Like, I don't want to put Coke in it. I just want to have the cross.
No.
Like, so no, good. Don't
they put
do
some
that.
Flour in it. They're like, I'm just going to go bake something.
Well, so it's so funny because I had a friend of mine who was going on a bachelor party. He was like, oh my God. Yeah, my friend, like, he found on Etsy all the Coke crosses from Cruel Intentions. So we're doing it. We're going to Vegas and we're doing all this Coke. And I was like, okay,
Christ.
but there, I was looking it up. And I was like, okay, wait, let's see what these look like. And there's a whole article from like 2 years ago about like, yeah, the person who designed the Coke cross for this movie is like, yeah, people are on it all the time. Like, oh, where can I get it? Where can I get it? If they sell it on Etsy, it's like, oh, how much Sweet and Low can fit in this crucifix?
Yes. I read that article because you reposted it on Twitter or something, I think. And it's truly incredible. Like, the cultural grip that this prop has had on, like, people for the last 20 years is actually, like, amazing. I mean,
but
it's
also
so
just
good.
People flat out being like, oh, yeah, I'm doing Coke.
Yeah.
That's why I got this.
That's why I want it.
When I went on Etsy, I just searched a Cruel Intentions Coke cross. And the amount of cocaine memorabilia that is selling on Etsy... Like coasters with like four lines of Coke like drawn on them, or like, please don't do Coke in the bathroom cross stitches.
Oh my god.
A classic.
It feels like a niche here where you could like carve in your market. You know what I mean? You start your own shop, but it's only related to Coke products.
Right.
It's definitely a bit now. One of my friends who has 100% never done Coke in her life has a cross stitch, please don't do Coke in the bathroom, in like her cutesy little apartment. And I was like, rest assured, nobody
you
is doing Coke in
this bathroom.
You
haven't had a glass of wine, honey. What are you doing?
I mean, it's just, I love like how this movie is designed. Like, the Coke cross is obviously the best example, but is it, I think it was the same article where the costume designer was talking about doing these sort of like 18th century styled like costumes and then throwing like a Dolce and Gabbana suit over them, like like, it's Upper West Side, rich preppy kid New York, but at the same time it does have like this air of like people at court. This
I feel like everything Sarah Michelle Gellar wears is like such a statement. Like,
oh, I love it.
Awesome.
Like every single, like, I think about that one where it's like maybe a jacket or something, but she has like that gold shirt thing going on with like a I don't even know what the fuck she's wearing,
it's
but
really
I could not stop looking at it because it was so cool.
Well, the funny thing is that it looks like half the thing she's wearing is half lingerie, half like boss lady suits. Yeah. And you're just like, this is the perfect mix of who Catherine is as a character, right?
Yeah.
She is the person in control, but also she wants to be sexy underneath. So it's like blazer on top, you know, not even bra underneath, like fucking like sexy, shrill
corset,
lingerie.
Bustier thing. Yes. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Maybe that's like the issue with like the new Gossip Girl being rebooted. They're trying to like girl bossify Cruel Intentions, and you just can't do that. I haven't seen it, but
well, I'm glad you told me
it was R-rated, Joe, because that was my one question. I was like, did they make it like R-rated for HBO, or because the original was on CW? But I mean, and I would, without having seen the new Gossip Girl, I mean, the intent of the original was very much to shock you. Like, you know, they had a whole advertising campaign about like, oh, every parent's worst nightmare. Don't let your children watch the show.
Season 2.
Iconic ad campaign.
And so Cruel Intentions also kind of does that, but like, it was meant to be this small film. Like, there wasn't a lot of hope for it. And so it's just kind of funny. They're like, oh, we're going to shock this tiny audience we have because none of our stars are famous yet.
Well, or none of the audience can go to see it because they're all underage.
Yes, yes. I feel like that's the thing, is like, what I kind of like love about it is it does feel like this movie you could see at Sundance or something, because it's ostensibly like five actors and like not many locations. And like, while the locations are super expensive, it does feel, you feel the low budget nature of it. I feel like it gets elevated a little bit almost with just like the soundtrack and the choices they make there.
Oh, amazing.
But like, it does feel kind of small, which I like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really give you like a grand like scope of this world.
That's why the book was turned into a play. But what I find so fascinating is like the book itself, when it first came out, I mean, again, in 17, like whatever, it was hated. Like critics were like, this is garbage. This is trash.
It's trash.
And in the ensuing years since, has gone on to become like, oh no, this is like classic literature. Mm. This is high art. Mm-hmm. And it's like, these sex games, these like manipulative sex games between these fucking French aristocrats.
It's a prank war.
It's a perfect subject, right?
Yes. Like,
and translates so well to 1999 mm-hmm. New York.
Mm-hmm. And 100%. Teenagers. Like, yes. I think that's the smartest thing for me is you can totally see adults doing this because mm-hmm. it's a sexy adult world, right? Like, when you've got money, the only things that you want to do are either fuck people or fuck them over business-wise.
Right, it's eyes wide shut.
It's eyes wide shut, yeah. And so the idea of then transposing that onto teenagers and affluent teenagers makes perfect sense, but it also escalates the scandalous nature of the story, which I think is just really clever. Yeah. Like, who doesn't want to live this life, but also all of these teens are fucking terrifying.
Yes. Oh, people today talk. I mean, look, I am the number one person who will say if I walk down Melrose in Los Angeles, I'm terrified of the teenagers nowadays because I feel like they will all bully me. I am way more scared of these teens than any other teenage form. Like, they would kill me if they saw me.
Yeah.
You know?
Except they wouldn't even. They would see you and then they would plan for 6 months and fall apart and then they'd pop up and be like, yeah, I did all that.
Right. Like, I never even talked to you. Like, how did you, like, why did you do this to me?
It's the premeditation that's, like, really amazing.
Yes.
I think that another reason that this works so well transposed into, like, a teen setting is, like, it's the correct balance of, like, horniness and, like, miscalculation to, like, make things go terribly wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you can fuck someone, just don't fall in love with them. Like, this boy is 17. Of course he's going to fall in love with this girl who he's obsessing about for 6 months. Like, and I think that, like, this is one of the only teen movies that's, like, so, so frank about, like, sex and sexuality.
Yes.
Not in, like, a sex comedy, like, oh my god, everyone has so many hormones type of
way.
Oh my
god,
but, like,
I fucked a pie. You're like,
But I was trying, I mean, because this comes out, like, what, 4 or 5 months before American Pie? Like, 1999, I mean, Joe and I talk about this, like, it is, like, the year for movies.
It's the best year for movies.
The best year ever,
teen movies, but, like, talking about frankness and sexuality, I'm trying to think of, like, what the 80s counterpart would be, and I think it's probably Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But, like, obviously, like, that's a very earnest, genuine film, whereas this is not that.
There's no John Hughes here. Like, the character who seems like he should get the happy ending is fucking run over by a car and actually dies.
Yes.
Honestly, one
Which
of my favorite
crazy.
Parts of this movie. I love that he dies.
Oh,
because any other movie would have been like, no, he gets
he's
to
like,
be,
like, in the car with Reese at the end or something.
Yes,
I mean, it's one of those things, though, where it's like, he really shouldn't have died from that car crash. Like, they really should. I mean, like, not narratively speaking, but, like, just how he gets hit. I'm like, I don't think that would have killed him. And that's one of those things, too, where it's like, I mean, again, I'll stop talking about the original story after
this.
Oh, no, please.
Triple
it's
down
important.
On it.
The whole thing is that the music teacher character, again, played by Keanu Reeves, by the way, in Dangerous Liaisons, but, like, in French land, he challenged him to a duel when he finds out that he's fucked his child bride. So he's like, okay, cool. So he dies in a duel, which makes more sense, and also gives that character, like, this kind of, like, oh, fuck that guy, like, for killing Valmont. But this is, I almost don't like that it's, like, an accident situation when we lose Valmont, but at least he dies saving Annette, which is kind of that's an invention of this film.
Yeah.
Yes.
I do wish, I agree, that it was more, like I said, Meet Joe Black. Like, I keep thinking about that car crash because it is the car crash in my brain that lives rent free. It should have had that, especially because, like, that's the tone the movie's kind of walking, like, that camp, like, elevated, like, you could see a double, like, maybe not, like, three cars, but maybe like two cars.
I think it has a bit of it though, because when Ryan Phillippe is like lying there in pain, it's like he has one drop of blood like on his forehead and like a very artfully bloody knuckles. You're like, this man is fine. Or
I love you, Annette. Like, I'm dying, but I love you.
With his like, final breath.
He can walk it off. He looks great. So I do think there's like a certain level of we know.
It almost feels like Ryan Phillippe's agent is like, he's so pretty. Please don't do anything. Like, protect the face. He has to look good.
There is
a
clause in that contract for sure.
Yeah. Honestly, shout out to...
Protect the face.
You gotta protect the butt. Shout out to whoever decided the only bit of nudity in this movie should be Ryan Phillippe's butt.
And we love male nudity.
That's the quality.
Second shot that I'm pretty sure, at least for gay men, every gay man
turned a lot of gay men gay. Yeah,
like yes, I was like, oh, like I like that perfect ass.
Mm-hmm.
Gay, I'm gay, I'm gay.
And then you chase that ass for the rest of your life,
and you know what? Becomes your white whale,
my rosebud. Oh wait, no, yes. That's in the center.
God.
A+.
No, I mean, like, I haven't, and he has aged wonderfully. Like, he is
Oh, he still looks great.
I think he looks better now than he did 20 years ago. Like, I'm not agreed. Even lying.
I was at a Sinespu screening for the new Amazon series of I Know What You Did Last Summer. Another weirdly ill-advised reboot in the vein of Gossip Girl, where you're like,
we
this
kinda
is
like
not.
It, though.
I do kind of like it, because it's ridiculous.
It's weird. It's just so different from everything else.
It is an intentional exercise in trash, and I don't know what they're doing. I don't really know what they're trying to do, but I can't look away from it.
Yeah. Is like, it like a new episode drops and you're like, well, now I have to set aside all of my plans and watch this immediately.
Yes.
And then just critique it, and then wait for the next episode.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I watched Gossip Girl religiously in that exact same way, and I was like, yes. I hate myself, but like I have to do it. Yes.
Is it like that like morning show Riverdale kind of vibe?
Well,
or
different. It's very specific.
I love the morning show a lot. I fucking
and
love
I love
it,
Riverdale. So
see, I can't do Riverdale because I'm just like, it's giving me
same here
Ryan Murphy vibes, where I'm like, I need you to pay attention for more than one episode.
You can't send
someone to jail and then have them come out like one episode later and then
like
be like
it.
Oh, we're gonna do bare knuckle boxing now for an episode. Like, where is the serial killer? What is happening?
See, Riverdale was insane. Like, yeah, I quit in season 3 because I just got bored. Like, it is a wild show where, again, you can explain the plot to someone and you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? But it's watching it, I was like, I'm really bored, which at least with I Know You Last Summer, I'm not bored with it.
Right.
Well, because there's cult, there's like a whole twin switch, like A plot. It's insane. But I think my original point was I was at a screening for this and it was like a double bill of like the original I Know What You Did Last Summer. And Ryan Phillippe was there in his like Letterman jacket from the movie, and he looked great. He looked
good
so good. Yes.
The whole cast, I love like that. It's like these three, like the Reese, him, and Sarah Michelle. Like, I love how their careers all this time are all like intertwined, and they're all like in each other's movies. And like, he got her to be in this, and like,
even
they
Selma
are coming
Blair,
from
though.
That.
I mean, like,
yeah,
right.
Selma Blair, yeah.
Witherspoon and
true.
Selma Blair did Legally Blonde, like,
yeah,
2 years
exactly.
after this.
Yeah.
Selma Blair snapped so hard with Legally Blonde, and I just don't know if we talk about it enough.
She's amazing.
The best. And like we mentioned very briefly, but like the like 20-second Tara Reid cameo made me so happy. I was like, she's
I forgot
here.
About it so much.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, hey. And it feels like a perfect fit for her. Because I'm
makes
like,
it
that's
into...
about what she can manage.
That's her range.
And she's done.
Yeah.
She makes it into the opening credits, and I was like, oh my god, I did not know Tara Reid was in this movie. Between the first time I watched it and this time, I have fallen deeply in love with Josie and the Pussycat. So I was gotta see
perfect
my girl.
Film.
Yeah.
Tara Reid, it's one of those ones where I'm like, yeah, I don't think she's like the best actress, but honestly, like when you give her a part that works for her, and Josie and the Pussycat is one of those parts.
Exactly. Yes.
And yeah, I think she's totally fine here. And then, you know, we get Swoozy Kurtz's cameo, and also because
she's rules.
Because she's in the original.
Good. In Dangerous Liaison, she plays the Christine Baranski character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who I also forgot was in this.
That's we need one to, we extra need to, gay star. I'm pulling the train just stop for just so we can talk about her yes. because yeah. you were mentioning how like the Ryan Felipe butt shot made a lot of men gay. Mm-hmm. I'm sure like the Sarah Michelle Gellar Selma Blair kiss made a lot we'll of women gay.
We'll get yes. to it. Thank
and then
you.
Just for Christine Baranski just to exist in this movie, it's like how is this film not going to be adopted by the queer community in general? Right. Like yes. it's checking pretty much any box that you need. Like she comes in and is just a fucking fire hydrant of just incredible mm-hmm. like dialogue and facial reactions. Looks. She is so good, and like I hate everything about her, but oh, when yeah. she's like, we donated money to Colin Powell, I'm like, oh my god,
dying. Yes.
Because so y'all are in LA, right?
Yes. We are.
And this is a couple years ago, so I don't know if y'all, but there was a Cruel Intentions jukebox musical that premiered in LA. Like
I was gonna say, this deserves a full fledged yes. musical.
Well, it's yeah. basically the soundtrack turned into a musical, like
which makes sense.
Yeah. And of course, yeah, they sing Bittersweet Symphony at the end, but the one who plays the Christine Baranski role in the play, who gets to sing No Scrubs, by the way, when she fires Ronald,
yes.
but it's the mom oh, from so Home terrible. Improvement. It's the mom from Home Improvement.
Oh, Patricia huh? Heaton?
Yes! No, wait. Heaton? Wait, is that Everybody Loves Raymond?
I think that might be Raymond.
No, I think it is Patricia, but anyway, nevertheless. It is the mom from Home Improvement singing okay. No Scrubs. It's not very good, but it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, I have to keep listening to this because what is going on?
Patricia Richardson.
There you go.
There we go. Because yes, I was going to say, nice. Patricia Heaton is a huge piece of shit, and I would not be able to support that.
Yeah, she is.
I mean... The poster for the musical rules, it's sort of like the Benedetta poster, but instead, like, the...
but oh like, my god, the crossover we need and want.
Yes!
Paul Verhoeven direct a Cruel Intentions musical reboot when?
We could get him on the pilot.
Here's what it is. It's going to be the Sarah Michelle Gellar character in between the TV pilot that never got off the ground, where she's like a reformed former cocaine addict. And but this not. Movie, so she went off to the convent, and then her story is directed by Paul Verhoeven.
Actually, I mean, Paul Verhoeven could direct, like, an actual 100%. Adaptation. Because, yes. But, like, in French. Like, just do it in French.
Yeah.
I would watch the fuck out of that.
Yes. And, like, given I love Verhoeven so much, and I have a particular soft spot for, like, his visuals, which yeah. I feel like mm-hmm. everyone's always like, oh, the tone and the vibe, and it's so sexy. But, like, I would love to see him do, like, French opulence. Like, I think that he would rock that.
100%.
Oh. All right. Do you we'll think start the campaign immediately.
I feel like we're talking about like with the reboots and the remakes and everything. Do you think there, because I honestly don't know if there's a way to do this style of a movie in today's teens, because I feel like with technology and everything, it kind of, even though there's tech in this, obviously with phone calls and like kind of with the computer and stuff like that, but like it's sort of just perfect on the cusp where it doesn't play too much into the plot. Where I feel like you can't reboot it with today's teenagers because I feel like that's just Euphoria or something like that. But
it's,
like,
you know what it really is?
We've kind of done it to death already.
It's
you know?
The voyeurs. Even though I kind of like that movie.
That's not like funny though.
Well, yeah, it's very, very
like, what is there a movie today that's like Cruel Intentions funny?
Well, but I think that's the issue, because I mean we are getting supposedly a new reboot of this, I think, on Amazon Prime, but it is going
we'll
to be
see.
A series. It's going to be a series. So I think honestly that's kind of the thing, because not to say an R-rated like teen sex comedy wouldn't do well today in today's box office, but yeah, like you said, I don't think we're getting movies like that, so I think we're turning to TV. I think that's what a lot of studios are doing.
But like even this is like a TV show. It's hard to picture because I feel like what works so well is Sarah Michelle Gellar as the villain. Like, if you stretch that out over 10 episodes, I feel like that could wear a little bit thin. Yeah. Like, because I feel like by making it a TV show, then you're, like, investing probably more in, like, the sort of, like, that angle of it, right?
They'll
At
have
least,
to
like,
make
that's probably the pitch.
That relationship more
okay.
interesting.
So I'm going to go, like, a weird deep cut that... I don't know that any of you are going to be able to follow
Dive
me
in,
on, but...
yes.
Okay, so I'm a huge fan of an Adrian Pastar show called Profit from, like, the mid-90s.
Oh,
and
respect.
It's basically... So it was a one-and-done, canceled after, like, 8 episodes, but it was him whose life was ruined by this giant company, and he becomes like a minor sociopath who every episode he targets one person in the company so that he can eliminate them, sometimes by like murder and like nefarious means, but a lot of the time it's like sexual blackmail or exploitation and other things. So like every episode he's whittling down these people who oppressed him and like contributed to his bad upbringing while slowly climbing the ranks to get closer to the person who ran the company. So I could see a TV version of this being like, okay, we have to get rid or like play like some kind of shenanigan on like one person in society and like get rid of them, and then we're like making our way through.
I like the idea, but that does sound very episodic, and I feel like we don't get like a lot of episodic narratives unless you're on CBS anymore.
Which like should come back though, because like I feel like there is such a creature comfort in having episodic TV. I mean, like that's why I loved like the first season of The Mandalorian for like what it was, because it was like, oh, this is kind of nice where it's just like its own, like while like there is like a kind of a through line, it was kind of nice where it's just like that's just it. And like that's why I keep like I will always go back and rewatch Twilight Zone episodes. I've seen them all like 100 times, but it's like so nice to be like, cool, here's this show that's just going to give you a new episode every week, and like it's a story, you get your story, it's in and out in fucking 30 minutes or an hour, and you're like good.
But also there's, you know, there's a very happy medium where like it's a very serialized show, but it like uses the episodic like restriction to its benefit, which I feel like has totally disappeared.
I wonder
if it's because of just like with streaming and like again seasons of television being dumped at one time, they're like, oh, we don't need episodic because they get it all at once. So
it's
what is
an 8-hour movie. 100%. It's just like the plot of one movie strung out over 8 episodes.
Oh my god, if I hear one more person be like, oh, it's an 8-hour movie, oh, it's a 10-hour movie, like
no, shut the
fuck up. It's either a series or a movie. But I take your point, Jordan, with The Mandalorian, and even like the way that Disney has rolled out its MCU shows on Disney Plus, like it's really, I think it's a reason to advocate for standalone episodic TV that is still 100%. Serialized, because you can create so much more buzz and momentum. Like it has to be the right property. We are talking about Star Wars and Marvel, so kind of
two of
big
the biggest
examples
in the world. But like even like with HBO, like I feel like honestly, like given the pandemic, like the shows that I feel have caught wind the most are the shows that are week to week, like Mare of Easttown, White Lotus, Ted Lasso. Well, like all these shows are like week to week versus dump. You know,
but do you remember when WandaVision was airing week to week and people were just complaining? They were like, it was a real stupid idea to release this week to week. They should have just dumped it all at once so we could stream it. Then people wouldn't
lose
interest.
Except Disney got so much fucking buzz out
and
of
it's,
that.
It's like, I mean, it does. It builds. I mean, and I'm like, Game of Thrones ended 2 years ago. Do y'all not remember watching that week to week? Like, that was that was an event. Like
an event,
What the modern version of water cooler conversation is.
Well, right, but we all have short-term memory loss now. Yeah, so.
Of course.
Honestly, you saying Game of Thrones ended 2 years ago, I was like, wow, it's been 2 years? Like, fuck.
That was when everything started going downhill. It was the 2019 it year really where, was. Like, yeah. Marvel, Game of Thrones,
everything
and Star Wars were all ending at, like, the same time.
And
it just,
two of three of those had
stuck
the landing.
Yeah, it was, like...
one, stuck the landing, my bad.
You know what? We should blame Game of Thrones for everything. I feel like that needs to come back.
Yeah. Game of Thrones
also,
and cats.
Hey, watch it. Watch it. This is I stand cats.
A cat's positive podcast.
This is, yes. Both the pet and also the film.
For sure. Okay, wait. Oh, okay, I have to... So we were talking about TV. We were talking about a potential reboot of this. I think that we have to mention very briefly the failed Cruel Intentions reboot pilot that was maybe ahead of its time, starring Sarah Michelle Gellar, which is obviously like a great... use that I feel like is happening more and more often, and we're like, well, we'll take the actual actor because IP is so valuable right now, we'll like take the actual actor and put them back into the thing like 20 years later.
So have y'all seen this?
I could only find clips, but I watched all the clips that I could find. Have you seen the whole thing?
We have.
Okay. I don't
How
know where
it?
You found it, but
we'll mail it to you after.
Oh, thank you.
So here's the thing. I think it starts really rocky. It starts with like, oh, we have to remind people that it's the movie. So like they play Bittersweet Symphony in the first 5 minutes of this pilot. There's a lot of clunky, like, remember what happened 15 years ago type things. But honestly,
Sarah Michelle Gellar gets interviewed and they're like, well, you had a high school scandal and, you know, do you want to comment on that? And she's like, that was 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like clunky dialogue where you're like, okay, movie, like, I get it. It was also supposed to air on NBC, which
a mess.
Here's
not
the
a
thing.
Good choice. So
this pilot, well, I agree to an extent because, again, when I think of NBC, I'm like, well, Hannibal, like, no one thought Hannibal
Thank
was going to do well.
Granted,
that was violence. And what Cruel Intentions gives us is sex. And this pilot, yeah. I was kind of like, honestly, I don't know if this would play on NBC because there is some stuff in there. And it's
There's
very
There's some racy stuff, yeah. It should have been on the CW. Let's just put it
out
there. Yeah,
but I will say that after you get past that rocky first act, I was actually really invested in the plot of this story, which, Joe, I mean, do you want to... You can jump in with your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. So Trace and I had an issue with the main guy. So the idea is that there's a guy who's living in Kansas, and you're, I think, supposed to recognize that his mom is the Reese Witherspoon character, but
right.
It's, like, not her.
So
it's just
played
her.
By some random
no,
actress.
It's Kate Levering, and I only know her because I used to watch this show on Lifetime called Drop Dead Diva, where this...
Right.
Oh, yes, a classic.
Being
okay,
now.
So she was the bitchy rival at the law firm in Drop Dead Diva, and she takes over the Reese Witherspoon role because Reese Witherspoon was like, I'm not doing an NBC
Absolutely not.
Sequel.
Yeah.
Yes.
I wonder why.
She's like, I'm busy doing the morning show. I'm literally raking in the
Yes.
Collecting
busy like
money.
Running one of the most like profitable production companies.
Yes,
exactly. Okay, so she had a son. So the one time that she and Sebastian fucked, she got pregnant, had a teenage. She now has
of
a teenage
course.
Son.
Naturally.
It's played by this guy named Taylor John Smith. He's absolutely.
Hey, wait, his
terrible.
Name is Taylor John Smith.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a name you pull
oh, sorry,
out
no,
of.
That's the actor's name. The character's name is Bast.
Bash.
Okay, that's
bash.
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 That's
bash.
Like
that's
Sebastian.
Like naming
yeah.
your person like John Doe. What?
Well, here's the thing: it's a boring Blando name because he is a boring,
he's
Blando,
Blando person.
Like,
yes.
So it's clear that basically, yeah. So he's working in Kansas, and basically his dad dies while getting a blow. He's getting roadhead.
Wait.
He's getting roadhead. He's getting roadhead from another man, and when he comes, he drives into a train.
Into a train and dies.
So we have this thing where, like, Bash, like, oh, he's, like, at the funeral, he finds his real dad, Sebastian's journal, in, like, his mom's things. And he's like, you
it's
lied to me
It's meant to be
about...
the same one from the movie.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's like, you lied about my parentage. I'm gonna go find my sister, my aunt, Catherine, aunt. Or whatever.
Yeah.
So then... We get Catherine, and she's newly married. She's a recovering coke addict, and...
Naturally.
Peter Gallagher comes in as Sebastian's dad, so he's, like, the villain of the season.
Kind of like that.
Oh, he's great. He doesn't get enough to do, because, really, it's a pilot, so they're just setting everything up.
Yeah.
You know, Sarah Michelle Gellar finds out that her husband is having an affair with her assistant, but then it's later revealed that she's also fucking the assistant, so there's, like, a lesbian makeout.
Let's
go. I'm seeing Brooke being like, oh, yeah, I saw
well,
that clip.
Well, oh, yeah, I definitely, that's the one
Brooke,
that I went
like,
looking
I
for.
I watch clips.
Well,
one
specifically.
One clip on repeat.
Well, the thing is, when I was, like, researching this pilot after you guys brought it to my attention, I was like, the very first thing that I found was like, oh my god, and they made her like canonically bi in like the pilot, and I was like, great, that's the kind of thing that I like to see. That's
it's
what
the representation we need and want.
Coke addicted bisexual schemers.
And it's clear that basically, like, I mean, because here's the thing, I left the pilot being like, I want more of this, because it's clear that the narrative would have been split. We would have had Catherine with, because Annette is, I guess, moving in with them because her son won't leave. So it's going to be like,
it's
Catherine.
A bad character choice. They should have written her out.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily agree, because I actually would like, I don't know what we're going to get because we only get two scenes between them, but like, I would love to see more Catherine and Annette going tete a tete with each other and like figuring shit out. But the other half of the narrative is going to be this son who's going into like, because because Catherine has a stepdaughter, and it's like, oh, he's going into the world of the rich kids, and it is. So boring. And so it's clear that the series would have been split between the adults and the kids, and like the adults and kids together. But honestly, it's not a bad pilot. Oh, and it
it's fine.
It does end with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Oh my god.
She,
It's the best.
This I also found this.
No,
weird.
You can tell it. You can tell it, Joe.
Okay, so at the end of it, it's like Catherine does her voiceover where she's like, haha, I put this into action. I've been watching Bash his entire life. So she knew about him the whole time. And she's been waiting for this moment so that she can do corporate espionage bullshit. Who cares?
She was driving the train.
What's that?
She was driving the train.
That killed his
Honestly, I would.
She's just got a train conductor hat.
That's like that's like the episode 5 reveal. Yeah.
If they reveal that.
She was the one who set up the dad with the gay escort. So she's in her office and she's remembering Sebastian and how obsessed and in love with him she was. And she's like, so it's her sitting at this desk. She's got a giant window screen that's like the computer. So it's pictures of Ryan Philippe. And then she starts masturbating and you see the figure of Sebastian walking in and you're like, oh my God, did they get Ryan Philippe back? No, they did not. They got a really bad stunt actor who doesn't look like him at all. But she's like totally like furiously going at it. And then she looks out the window and she sees that Bash is looking at her. And she just like continues going at it. No. And is like, I'm going to fuck you later. Yeah.
But okay, but they are blood related, which is not something that... But also she has a giant crucifix on her wall and she pulls it off, like slides down a platform on it, and there are 2 vials of coke.
So it's a giant version of the cross cocaine.
Oh my God.
Maybe the best thing.
Gorgeous.
And so, like, again, it's not a terrible pilot, but like the way it ends, I'm like, holy fuck, I want more of this.
That is an that what you just said, hook, line, and sinker, I am in. Like, that's all I need.
They understood what this movie is about. Like,
The director of the film directed the pilot. Like, he came back
there and did
Roger Cumble, not like the best director.
Because he does Cruel Intentions 2, lest we forget, come back for 3.
But he also did The Sweetest Thing, like, which, not a good movie, quote unquote, but a movie that I love.
Mm-hmm. Can you go back? He did After We Collided, and I know that.
Oh, God.
Who the fuck are the 2 people in that again?
So, after famously Harry Styles fanfic, for those who don't know.
Right, that's what it was. Okay,
After We Collided is the sequel. We haven't because I don't really care about Harry Styles fanfic.
Shocking.
I don't fanfic about real people really weirds me out.
It's weird and uncomfortable.
It's very weird. But After We Collided stars some random dude and some random girl who is Catherine Langford's sister. Famed director Roger Cumble directed not even the original, the sequel. He also directed Furry Vengeance.
A
little range there in the filmography.
Okay, well, you know what? Everyone has to pay the mortgage. So sometimes you gotta make a furry vengeance.
I have a, Brooke, on the point that you brought up earlier, I have a question for y'all. As like a horror podcast, I feel like this has become a big thing with horror films in the Halloween movies. I'm guessing they'll probably do something with the Exorcist movie. I think they already are, where you bring back the star for the reboot. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? Because like, it's, I get it, and I totally see like the market tie and the reasons for it. We've seen where they reboot and it doesn't work, where it's just completely new. Like, do you think that it's a good thing that the industry is pivoting this way and how we deal with IP? Do you prefer otherwise? Because I feel like it's like very pervasive within the horror.
So, do you mean specifically genre? With like doing a reboot and bringing back old cast members? It's funny because the earliest example I can think of that actually is Psycho 2, was a box office success, but it didn't really kickstart a trend back in the 80s because that was, 23 years after the fact. I don't mind it. I mean, like, Joe and I are major Scream fans, and we will always welcome the return of Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox, and David Arquette.
Of course, I'm so
excited. I think, like, what is interesting, and I feel like the bar is literally so low, but, like, it is exciting to see these actors that I feel like might otherwise be considered, quote-unquote, past their prime or, like, not able to lead a film in the same way that they used to, like, getting that spotlight because of the iconic character that they played. Mm-hmm. Like, it is exciting to see, like, actors and actresses and like their 40s, 50s, 60s being like, you are the moment. You are like who people are coming to see because of this character that you played when you were like 20.
I mean, even Chucky, the series, like we're getting Jennifer Tilly back and it's like,
we have to stand.
There's nothing better.
But you notice though, it's all women, right? Like, I mean, with the exception of Psycho, like, we're getting Jamie Lee Curtis back. We're getting Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox, Will David Arquette. We're getting Jennifer Tilly back. Like, what are some other examples, Joe? Like, can you think of any other legacy sequels?
I think it's tricky because particularly in horror, we often end up gravitating to our final girls, right? Yes. Like, right. It's not uninteresting that a lot of the people that we're talking about are also from slasher films, right? Like, we're not seeing exactly a renaissance in certain areas. And I think we see this in things like Cruel Intentions and Melrose Place. So it's like the soaps are the other place that it often happens, also a female-dominated genre. So I wonder if it's like, I mean, A, we all know that Hollywood historically mistreats women. Like, it doesn't value them. As soon as they start to age out, it's like, oh, well, you can either be a mom or you can fuck off. So I do very much welcome it if it's actresses who I think deserved more of a fair shake, or we like kick them to the curb. And honestly, I think Sarah Michelle Gellar is one of them. I definitely think that Jennifer Tilly is one of them. Yeah. Like, we don't value people until we recognize, oh, you're attached to a famous IP that people fucking love. Yeah, maybe we should give you another chance and a little bit of money. Yeah.
But it's funny, Jordan, that you mentioned The Exorcist, because did y'all watch The Exorcist TV show that premiered on Fox a couple years ago?
So good.
I mean, basically, I mean, it was advertised, oh, like, we're just doing The Exorcist TV show, whatever, blah, 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 blah. But and it's starring Gina Davis. And that's all you knew. Okay, cool. We're just doing a possession series. Episode 5 of that series reveals that Gina Davis is actually Reagan McNeil from the original film, who like changed her identity. Fuck. And it's awesome. It basically acts as a direct sequel to the Exorcist film, and it's really fucking good. But that's really it's not cool. Linda Blair. So you have this character that is recast with Gina Davis, but it still works. But I think it works. I think it works better because they didn't spoil that in advance. Like, again, you don't find out until 5 episodes in, and they did not spoil that in the marketing.
Right. Although, to the show's detriment, because nobody fucking watched that.
Then it gets canceled so quick. Yeah.
And then got canceled.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. That's always the struggle. Yeah. I mean, look, long story short, too long didn't listen. I would love to see the reboot of Cruel Intentions 1, you, Sarah Michelle Gellar and company, to their full potential. It would be really exciting. And also, like, update this in a way that preserves, like, the energy of the original source material. Like we talked about with the Gossip Girl reboot. It is weird where, like, if you're trying too hard to shock the audience or you want to, like, get the audience on your side right off the bat, it's never as smooth as you think it's going to be. Like, just let people revel in the, like, oh my God, I can't believe we're watching this.
Well, also, what's shocking now? Like, what is shocking that teenagers do now? Because, you said, like, shows like Euphoria, it's like, well, this is every parent's nightmare.
Right. But it's even at that point, it's like, I feel like we're so, like, people were saying that about Euphoria, and they're like, my God, this show's so crazy. And, like, you watch the first season, and, like, sure, it's, like, scandalous at times, but it's like, okay, like, the internet has so desensitized us that it's just, like, at this point, like, nothing is really shocking. So, like, it was, like, friends of mine were, like, people were like, my God, this is so, like, risque or whatever. And I'm like, they're just fucking, like, whatever. Like, we've seen this before. Like, it's not really, I don't know. And so,
I mean, I like that show, but I feel, I like
Euphoria too, but it's just like, I don't think, like, it's viewed through that, like, skin. And that's why I just think it's hard for Cruel Intentions to get rebooted in general. But
what I find exciting about Cruel Intentions, the original, is, like, the aspect of the sex games. Like we said, it's this very adult thing that teenagers are playing, but what makes it more adult than, like, the actual sex having part is, like, the calculation.
Totally,
and, like, the premeditation and thinking about, like, these chess pieces on a board.
There's so many pieces. Like, there's so many things that, like, again, like, everyone's doing, like, three things at once. Honestly, the closest I can think of a similar time period piece is, like, Wild Things. Like, Wild Things similarly does that very, very well, but that brings adults into it more so than Cruel Intentions does.
Okay, a reboot, but it's a crossover between Wild Things and Cruel Intentions.
I mean, would be there.
So it's like Susie versus Catherine.
Cruel Things. Okay, wait.
Wild Intentions.
But we kind of got that, Joe, in Ringer, the Sarah Michelle Gellar TV series in the CW. No,
that show needed to be so much more suspicious. No, and also keeping those twins apart for an entire fucking season and then canceling it.
I know, but they literally did a Wild Things subplot where the two girls accused the teacher of raping one of them, and then he was in on it.
But honestly, the funniest thing is how badly it plays.
Yeah, yeah. It was bad.
It doesn't work in the show because you're like, oh fuck, you can't do this anymore.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Wild Things is like so of its time. Well, that's on the list. We'll cover it one day.
Oh, yeah. Wait, God, yes. Jordan, wait, have y'all not seen Wild Things? Oh my God.
Oh my God, Jordan. You are in for a fucking treat.
I know. Right? It's weird because like this time period is like with this movie too, it's like that in between, because I'm a fucking loser and I see like everything and I've seen too many movies, but like this like late 90s early 2000s teen erotic like thriller. Rom-com erotic thrillers are like sort of a blind spot, because like I wasn't necessarily raised on like the 90210s and things like that, because I was like watching different shows or like movies, so like that tone I didn't get into until like late high school, college. So
you
like
can
it
just
was then
say
like
you were
starting...
closeted. It's fine.
No, but like okay.
he was
but,
watching
like,
PBS.
But like
Sesame
even
Street.
Like Scream is like I watched Scream, but like Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer. Like those kind of like these like late 90s slashers, I feel like are all kind of lumped in with this sort of time period. And even if you were closeted or not, like I just wasn't like I would rather watch. I was seeing like what like a Saw versus like I Know What You Did Last Summer, just because of like the time period and when it was coming out. So if I'm catching
you wanted
up,
real horror.
Yeah,
no, I did not.
John, we're just fucking with you.
I know.
No,
I'm gonna hit you with a car.
We're used to people calling I Know You Did Last Summer like not it's teeny bopper horror, right? It's WBCW horror.
Like, exactly. Well. And like, but like even with Sarah Michelle Gellar, like I never watched Buffy and like I still haven't watched Buffy, and I know that's like a problem. But like it's I wasn't great. Like I mean I can't really stand the person who created it. But like I stand Sarah Michelle, but like I totally understand like the cultural cachet that she had. But like even watching this movie, I hadn't seen much that she was in, and I feel like when we were talking about like her, you know, being able to like come back and get in things, you just sort of look at her filmography and it's like really like those 90s are such a peak and then like such a big fall off, and like the only one who really comes out of this like thriving is kind of Reese and Christine Baranski.
Yes,
like of the whole cast.
And Christine Baranski was like the already get. Right, she was the get for
and
this.
She's been killing
she
it
like
forever.
It was amazing that they got her on like the shoestring budget that they had.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's like you look at Reese's like career though, it's like I forget what she has like right before this, but like within the same year it's like this and Election, and then like she's just like rolling out the hits, and then it rolls
a couple years earlier and
exactly.
But yeah, because like Reese's Room was on a track for sure. I mean like so
she's
it,
like
it was Pleasantville right before this, but that's, like you said Election like got her like, oh, critics were like, oh, this girl really can't. I mean she'd already been noted for stuff, but like Election was like the thing, but then Legally Blonde is what got her like mainstream famous.
Yes,
but you even look at this and like she is so clearly a fucking star. Like that was one of my biggest watch notes, is like you were watching the cast and like Sarah Michelle and Ryan, they're popping, but like even though we're saying like Reese has like a kind of boring
she's the most
story,
boring character,
she's the you can kind of see that she has star power. Like you see that there's like something there that will like propel her down the line versus what the other cast members have.
You are right, like she's the straight woman in all of this like wild buffoonery that's happening in this movie. And in every iteration of this, you're just like, oh, this character's such a fucking drag. But both Reese Witherspoon and I would argue even Michelle Pfeiffer in Dangerous Liaisons I care about Reese Witherspoon in this movie, and not just because it's Reese Witherspoon. I do think she does a really good job of like earning empathy and from the viewer.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I mean, Michelle never misses anyway. So
I like about Reese Witherspoon's performance in this movie is that like this could very much be like a super passive like waifish character, but like in the first scene that she has with Ryan Phillippe, she's like, I'm not interested in whatever you think that you're about to do. Like, I feel confident in myself as a woman, and I don't think that she ever strays from that, even when she's falling in love with him. Like, it's not like he doesn't really ever succeed in tricking her, because even that final scene where they're before they reconcile, when they're yelling at each other, it's like he's breaking his own heart as much as he's breaking hers.
She's also shown her intelligence, and so it makes when he is like playing her, it's even more like, honestly, watching this again, I was like, oh God, like he is a huge asshole. Like I always knew he was, but like I was like, oh, like watching this in 2021, it's like it's really mean and kind of hard to watch him play her. Mm-hmm. More so because she has proven herself to be an intelligent person and not just like some dumb waif.
Yes. Yeah. absolutely wild that there's a scene in this movie in which they get a girl drunk without her knowing, and then Ryan Phillippe goes down on her. It's not that I was watching it and being like, oh my God, how could they have ever put this on screen? But I was like,
cancel this movie. Yeah.
I was like, that's 1999 yeah. for I mean, sure.
Mm-hmm. Again, in the original version of this, it's an older man raping a child, like, right. like a 14-year-old girl. I mean, granted, it was Uma Thurman in Liaisons, but yeah, it's like, it's so this is the tasteful version of that rape scene, basically. Yeah.
Right. It's absolutely crazy. But like, I think that, you know, it's all part of this movie's charm. It's part mm-hmm. of like, it's just so weird. I love how sexy they make the Ryan Phillippe and Sarah Michelle Gellar seduction scenes. Oh, like
the massage.
Oh,
it's like the ultimate legendary. Like, this movie is all about blue balling. Like, Sarah Michelle Gellar just has his balls just in her fucking hand, like clenched.
Her saying down boy to his dick so good. Is
and her delivery
my favorite
of it.
Moment.
Oh. Yes,
of course. Yeah,
I mean, her
she has a line where she was like, oh my god, I was like, she calls it like poontang or something.
Yeah,
like forbidden pootie, and I was like, "What?"
Some of the dialogue was like so cringe because you're like, "Oh, this is so over the time." When she was like the parentals and things like that, I'm like, "Oh God!" Like I forgot like that was like a thing and a bit that people said.
How about
very
when...
much an adult writing teen dialogue, but then other times you're just like, "Oh, but when they speak like adults." And it's coming out of teen mouths. Mm-hmm. That's when the salacious kind of sexiness works. Right?
How about when Ryan Phillippe turns her down and she's just like, "I want to fuck." Oh. Like,
I want to fuck.
When she says, "I'm the Marsha fucking Brady of the Upper East Side."
That is the line of the film.
Yes.
I mean,
and sometimes I want to kill myself.
It's so like. Chef's kiss.
Yeah.
And, again, there's something to mine there, again, to humanize this character with that. Because, I mean, she doesn't get humanized because she's a horrible person. But, like, that's the line where you're like, well, I at least understand why she is this way.
She makes points.
It's first world problems for you, unfortunately. But, like, I understand why you are this way.
But I do love the fact that the film takes the time to acknowledge that being a girl is way harder than being a man. Because, like, this movie didn't have to have a feminist message. Like, that's what the Reese Witherspoon character is. It's like, be careful of who you give your heart to. It could be broken, but maybe also you'll get lucky and convert an asshole and he'll become like your shining white knight.
Right.
Yes.
But then you've got the Catherine character being like, I don't get anything if I'm the good girl. So the only way that I can get what I want is to be secret. And it's like, that's where a whole bunch of like iconic texts have come from, is this idea that girls have to play sneaky because it's the only kind of cultural cachet that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, even within that, I feel like there was an article I was reading on The Repeller where they were talking about Catherine's character and how she's playing when she's not with Ryan, like the straight perfect daughter and like this like pinnacle of like great heterosexuality, like what you want your daughter to be. And then obviously like on the side to everyone else, she's just like this nasty, loathing character, and how that like performance as a way of like self-preservation is sort of like tied to queerness. And with you saying that she comes out as bi, I think is fascinating because it is that thing where she's like constantly playing like with these communities and like ways in which she can protect herself without ever letting herself like become ultimately vulnerable.
Yes.
And like, she is obviously the villain, but like you can see that there is like a queer read. Even, I mean, obviously like the kissing sequence is iconic and has been parodied forever, but like even within that, you can see that there are like threads to her character that like have ties to the queer community at large.
Yeah, I mean, let's start with the fact that she's like, "You've never made out with your girlfriend. That's how you practice kissing." Okay,
right.
Like, what? Keep telling yourself that. Like,
I don't. It's a phase. We all go through it, right?
Yeah, everyone makes out with their friends.
But yeah, even early on, I mean, you know, she throws out the Trevor's a F slur, and it's like, I never for once believe that this, as horrible as this character is, I don't think she's homophobic.
No. Yeah. No. I mean, even the barb that she throws Sebastian, where she's like, "Oh, we're going to write in your diary, could you be more queer?" Like, it feels very much like she's taking individuals down and not a community down.
I think it's more so that she knows that Sebastian would be bothered by that.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Not so that she thinks it's like, I don't know. I mean, again, I saw you kind of like give a face when I said that. So, I mean, I don't know if you have a different opinion on it.
I think, unfortunately, this is a bit of a byproduct of its time, where saying the F-slur, making fun of queer people, treating them as not great was the thing to do, right? Yeah. Because at the end of the day, the target audience was still either men or teenage boys.
100%.
And what could be worse for that demographic? So I don't disagree with you specifically with regard to Catherine, but I do think that the way that, what's the guy's name from
Blaine is Greg? Evil?
Blaine Eric Greg. Mabeus.
Yes.
Yeah. So Eric Mabeus is queer character. Like the fact that he is immediately like queer shamed and like the whole thing about, like, wouldn't your parents hate to find out that you're a fudge packer, which I always hated that saying.
Yeah.
I do get that. Honestly, the only scene where I was like, this is like too, like, it's so dumb, but it's when he's throwing away all of his CDs and he's like, oh, I'm going to keep Judy Garland. I was like, honestly, that was the most offensive gay thing to me in the movie because it was like, okay, come now on. We're just going into a stereotype. Right. I do agree that the fudge packer line, like, obviously it's triggering. It's like great. Fucking upsetting. But nothing he's saying is a lie. Like, I fully believe that this man's dad would be, like, livid and, like, want to disown his son for being gay. So, Philippi is 100% an asshole and playing into that very real fear.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I mean, I cringe when I hear the line, but I don't, I'm not, like, put off from the movie by it.
I mean, one thing that I appreciated this go around is the, maybe nuance is too generous the word, but the way that Joshua Jackson
plays his character,
where he's actually quite mask when he's around Ryan Philippe, and then he picks up the phone and he's like, Gregory?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're just like, he's code switching. So he's also playing
Dr. Death himself.
Right? Yes. And, like, you know, speaking with Ryan Philippe's character, like, during that whole situation, not great. But I do kind of love how Blaine Tuttle is, like, you know, basically talking about his conquest, and Philippe's like, good for you. Like, you go. Like, it's, they're clearly friends.
Yeah. No, I feel like that's the thing is, like, he and Ryan's character they're like buddies, and like obviously like Ryan has like a little bit of like,
it's not amazing,
it's not a great friendship, but like they're close enough, and like I feel like Greg is the one who gets like the worst shit done to him in terms of like his queerness, where he's like weaponized in all like on all sides.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it this way, but tell me if this changes y'all's view of it. So again, we're going to like compare what are these counterparts to the original. So this, the Joshua Jackson, Eric Mabeus characters in this one, you know, it's a gay guy and a closeted gay guy. In the original film, it is it is Valmont's servant who he blackmails into sleeping with one of Annette's servants uses that sex scene as blackmail to, like, get her letters to figure out who badmouthed her. So we're taking the lower-class characters from the original film and making them the gay characters in this film.
Right. I think this is the most contemporary kind of modernized take on it, though, right? Like, they wanted to acknowledge, oh, queer people would exist, and even rich people could be queer. So in some ways, I think I appreciate that there's at least that effort being made. I do think, Trace, what we would see as the equivalent of what you just described is actually in the Ronald character. And this film's not great treatment of race.
Yeah.
Yes. And
very much so.
It's just he's a music teacher with no money. Like, that's the aspect of the original. Whereas this one, it's he's a music teacher that has money, but is black.
Right.
The Christine Baranski line of "I got you off the streets," and he's like, I live on Park Avenue, is really funny. But other than that, I would say that I was like, oh, I forgot that this movie like has sort of a tongue-in-cheek look at like how people think about characters of color, but then it sort of falls into its own trap.
Yeah. I do love that he's so black.
Yes.
Yes, that entire sequence.
I mean, that works because of Christine Baranski's delivery, right?
Exactly.
She can do no wrong.
Brown sugar. No sugar.
Yeah.
It's so good. Well, I feel like that's the thing. It's like this movie, like, because you were mentioning like how this movie like recognizes that there could be queer people who are rich. And I feel like there's that thing in, maybe it's like movies or books, but like I feel like constantly there will be material where there is like just like rich queer people in period pieces or not, or like it's like such a taboo thing. I just like you saying that, I was just like constantly just thinking about like all the fucking period pieces where you have like a gay character or whatever, and they could be rich, and it's just like they're so viewed as like they're so fucking vilified. And this, it's like they're not vilified, but it's such a fucking tertiary character, and like with a reboot, would you want to, like...
Well, I know you haven't seen... I can't believe how much I'm talking about the Gossip Girl reboot of the series that...
I do not anticipate.
They're Go connected. Piss they Girl!
Well, they really
but
are. They really
That's the thing, is that, like, the Gossip Girl reboot, is I think, like, takes that in a angle? Very... Oh, super, yeah. super queer. And it's, like, you have a lot of, like, not just the kids, but the adults. Like, very visible, like, queer, well-off characters. Mm-hmm. And that, like, they still have their own problems... Of so it's I think that we talk a lot about, like, oh, better representation, or like different, more varied representation, but I think we are at a point where, like, if you want to look for the thing that you're looking for, you it's it. There yeah. it's just not as mainstream as you might think. But oftentimes I think that it still feels like very much like posturing when it's like gay people can be successful too, people of color can be famous or rich or whatever it is, like
that's,
it still
that's
feels
what it is.
Where it, very it, much like a presentation.
It doesn't feel like actual or like earned necessarily.
I don't know that we'll ever 100% get away from that though, just because of like how media is the way that it is.
Right. It's even like with, like, it's just, you see it like even in like a blockbuster where you're just like, this is cool, but you're like, it's totally pandering.
Mm-hmm. My favorite versions of like non-pandering queer representation that feels like radical but not like pandering is something like Hannibal, which I have to mention at every given opportunity. And may I just say that Hannibal Lecter in that is a very well-off man. He goes to the opera, okay? He has money, he has status. But like, that's the kind of thing where you're like, this is a complicated show about queer people, and like it doesn't feel like they're being like, guys,
like, look.
But I guess, but it's also never made explicit in that show. That's always a subtextual thing.
Exactly.
So it's not pandering, but it's also for me the opposite. I mean, again, and that's a queer creator, so it's like Brian Fuller.
Exactly.
Like, he could have made them explicitly queer if he wanted to.
He said that before, where he was like, it was like half NBC being like no, and him being like, well, I like to torture people.
Yeah.
So I like to keep them guessing.
So I mean, it's not pandering to me. I mean, again, like, for me, pandering is like fucking American Horror Story Coven, where it's like Ryan Murphy saying, oh, the gays just want bitchy one-liners. They don't care about plot. Just give them the bitches. They'll be fine. Which, funny, since we're talking about Cruel Intentions, but...
Hey, this movie has themes, okay?
This movie has a coherent plot.
Honestly, like, there is... You were saying that earlier, where you were like, everyone has their, like, three things that they're going on, and at one point, I wrote, like, I forget, like, who's doing what, and I'm just, like, kind of along for the ride, because, like, at some point, it's just, like, everyone's crossing each other, and, like, everyone has their own intentions, be that cruel, and so I was just like, sure, take me wherever you're going. I'm gonna have a time.
Yeah.
It's always, like, the Cecile stuff, which always seems so superfluous at first, until... Yes. I remember the first time I saw this... When it's revealed that Christine Baranski is the one who's been messaging Reese Witherspoon, I was like, whenever they said Mrs. Caldwell, I was like, who's Mrs. Caldwell?
Christine Baranski.
Yes,
yes,
but,
exactly.
But that's the thing, is like, so okay, then that makes him care about Cecile again now, which that's like the extra wrench where you're like, wait, what's happening?
Well, it's because the movie does, to a certain extent, forget about Ronald and Cecile until the very end, when it's like, we need to bring them back so that we can have a reason to get Sebastian into traffic at the end.
How do we feel about Cecile? Like, what happened? I think Blair is really good. So Blair, I didn't know this, was the oldest cast member here, out of the four. She was 26. Yeah. And she does seem the youngest, because she plays that young naivete, like, so well.
So well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But good lord, this girl gets used and abused in this movie.
I mean, the sex scene she has with Ryan, where she's, like, on the bed constantly trying to fuck at him after, and he's, like, not into it, is so funny, but you're also like, this is so cringe.
Because when
he shoves her off the fucking bed,
which so just funny. Happened earlier when Sarah Michelle Gellar pushed her off the couch.
This girl, her knees.
Yeah,
but I love how much physical comedy she gets to do as a result, because this movie,
secret society
like, this movie delights in having wordplay and sort of situational comedy, but it doesn't do a ton of physical things, because I don't think it wants to veer into straight comedy in that regard. But really, the Selma Blair character, like, Cecile gets to do all of that. Like, she gets to be vulnerable, she gets to be faux sexy, she gets to be real sexy, she gets to, like, be the product of manipulation, she gets to do a little bit of her own manipulation. Like, it it's a surprisingly rich character considering she's barely in the film for long stretches of time.
Yes.
Agreed.
I think that Roger Cummell mentioned in like when he was auditioning people for this, he would ask like everyone he was auditioning like how old they were because of like the intimate nature of like the scenes and everything, like sort of get a read. And apparently he asked Selma Blair and she was like, how old are you? And he was like, that's the energy that I need.
This is what I need.
Yeah, apparently he was like, she's the exact amount of like bratty rich kid that I wanted.
Also does give her a, I mean, again, I guess it's debatable because we don't really know what happens between her and Ronald, but like it does give her that, because originally she has to go back to the monastery and she is disgraced and ruined. but no, because this, it gives her that moment of handing Catherine the journal. And honestly, yes, it's a couple seconds, but it's like, oh good, like,
right,
you get your bit of revenge in this movie. Yes. So good for you.
And a great example of Selma Blair's acting in that, like, she has been this like totally like clueless girl the whole time, and when she hands that journal to Sarah Michelle Gellar, you can see in her eyes she's like, she's matured, she's in, like, she's come into her own. There's no sense of like she doesn't know what she's doing, even though we haven't seen her on screen for like 30 minutes
literally.
So
question on the pilot, it's kind of, it, so we get the journal, right? If you're his son and you get the journal and it's talking about his conquests and everything and how he wanted to fuck his half sister, would you
stepsister totally
would
different
you, sorry would you really want to go find that person? Like, I don't know if I would be like, I want to go meet the stepsister that my dad was trying to fuck and then got fucked over by. Like, that doesn't seem like
it's all under the auspices of like his mom will not tell him anything about his real dad, so he's like, well, I have to go to the only other person I know who knew
it all comes back to daddy issues.
You read it, she's like the worst fucking person according to this journal. And also he's so excited to read it and you're like, this is basically just like a little black book of like there's no fine reading in this.
But also, like, based on the interview that Sarah Michelle Gellar's character has, like, this is a worldwide scandal that she had, so he can easily Google this information. Right.
Oh, there's actually a joke in the pilot where Sarah Michelle Gellar's new husband says, oh, do they not have Google in Kansas?
Oh my god.
Of course. The classic
L-O-L.
Flyover state
lamp shading.
Yeah. I do wonder if Ryan and Reese's kids have seen this. I think that was one of the Letterboxd reviews I saw where they were like, do you think that Ava Philippe has
seen
this?
I swear mommy and daddy learned they wanted to fuck each other for
I real. Couldn't watch. Yeah, if this was my parents, I could not watch this movie. Which that would be a horrible, right? Like, I can't watch Cruel Intentions because it's my parents.
But like imagine like being Reese's daughter, like the older one, because she looks
exactly
literally
like
Reese in this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I feel like that would be even weirder where you're like, oh, it's just me. Like, it's just like
watching dad fuck me in this like 2 minute long sex scene.
I mean, okay. Not wrong, that's what it looks like.
Well, I think especially in this movie she like still has like sort of like that baby face look about her, which her daughter has,
which it changes literally like after election. The difference between election and Legally Blonde Reese is huge.
It's not fab, but she is just like, she has a fuller face in these younger
I think
films.
She grows into her like maturity.
Yes. I mean, it's crazy to me that Ryan Philippe and Reese Witherspoon were already dating when they like, and like he's the one that brought her into this.
Like, begged her.
But what's even crazier is that like they got married right after this. Like, I cannot imagine filming this movie and being like, okay, so like,
I totally believe in the longevity of our relationship. I feel really trustful of you.
But
now.
y'all mentioned, oh, has Sarah Michelle Gellar's career kind of like, it didn't stall, but she definitely was working a lot less, and Reese Witherspoon wasn't. But you know, Sarah Michelle, and this is not to complain or critique the fact that Reese Witherspoon and Ryan Philippe got divorced, but they separated, so they could probably like have alternate custody and take turns. Sarah Michelle Gellar and Freddie Prinze Jr. really started working on their family. Not to say that Reese Witherspoon and Ryan Philippe were not working on their family, but just like they and it could have been a result of like they were getting offered less roles, so they're like, fuck it, like let's just stay home and do this. They have the money, they just did Scooby-Doo, so they're fine.
Yes. I mean, look, Freddie Prinze Jr. and Sarah Michelle Gellar are like the only thing keeping heterosexual Hollywood together.
They're so adorable.
Scooby-Doo origin stories.
Yeah.
No, they're watching all the Will Smith Jada Pinkett drama like, yes, we're the last ones.
Like, they really are the last
ones. Surviving.
Yeah. And I
really
love
need Scientology to do it either.
Oh, isn't that so good? Like, they're not Scientologists. Thank God.
I love them. Like, it's so great. I love that. I love when real life couples have a movie where they're romantically together. It's even better that it's fucking Scooby-Doo. Like, it makes me so happy.
Well, it's better than, like, the Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz, because theirs is, like, a movie that doesn't exist. Like, so many of them are, like, awful movies where you're like, I mean, I see maybe
or it's
the love.
Here's the movie where our relationship began. Too bad we were married to other people and we just like fucking on this looking at you, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt.
Then you get the my favorite version where we're in a marriage and it's having a dissolution at the time of a movie playing out as a marriage dissolving with Eyes Wide Shut, where you're like, wow, everything is connected.
I mean, that one is like extra special because everything worked out
it's
in the end.
So beautiful.
Oh, no, that's also Scream 4. Courtney Cox and David Arquette were getting divorced during making that movie.
Mm-hmm. What do you think their relationship's going to be like?
Are they going to get back together? They need a new relationship milestone every Scream film, right? Yeah. So what is it this time?
I mean, he does not look great in terms of like his character.
Rude.
His character, he's unshaven. He looks like a
mess. He's got scruff, scruff, which in movie terms means he's
having a hard time. Right.
Yes. I don't know. I'll be excited to see it. We're huge Scream fans.
It looks so serious.
We'll see. I think they're hiding things.
I don't believe anything in that trailer.
Yes. We can't devolve into Scream theories. No. We'll be here for 3 hours. I actually think we've done a pretty good job talking about what happens in this movie, considering it's a pretty convoluted plot when you think about all the crossing and double crossing and triple crossing. Yeah, but I mean, like, I love that the movie is brave enough to be like their step siblings and they want to have sex with each other. Yes. And that is like a
from
central horny positive part of this film. It makes me happy.
The taboos. I was even like, okay, what was this rated R for? Strong sexual dialogue in sexual situations involving teens, language, and drug use. Like, I'm sure y'all have a listen that's like, oh my god, no, this other movie is way more graphic, but it's just like, again, like, there's something, even watching this, I'm 32 years old, watching this movie today, I'm still
scandalous.
Like, this just still feels like something I shouldn't be watching. Like, it is so fucking raunchy and scandalous for these 17, because it's not even that they're, because a lot of times movies will get over it, being like, oh, they're high school seniors, so it's like, they could be 17, they could be 18,
right.
But this movie opens with the start of senior year, so we know they're all 17.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I really think it's like the frankness in which this is a movie about sex. It's not a movie about like something else and then like has sex involved. Like, it's about sex games. And it's so, and I think that like it treats the teens in this very calculated way, and then at the same time like is able to juxtapose scenes like Sarah Michelle Gellar talking to Selma Blair and being like, oh, you had an orgasm, did you not know what that was? Mm-hmm. And it really like reminds you, oh my god, like,
I mean,
what is happening?
It's almost a satire though of like the 1%, like that's kind of what this is. And it's all, I mean, it's all very funny despite the fact that it's not funny. I don't know.
I think it
definitely pretty
has some biting sets, like satirical.
Oh, it's biting.
It's for sure.
Yeah. I love, and like, there's so, I think because like this was like a bit of a shoestring budget and the studio more or less like left them to their devices, which is always how you get the best movies.
Yes.
There's like a level, you were talking, Jordan, about like how you don't necessarily see the scope of this movie, but I think the sets that you do get so perfectly encapsulate like what the movie is trying to be. Like, Sarah Michelle Gellar's bedroom being like entirely in this like navy blue.
Oh my god,
it's like
iconic.
But with
it's
like
gorgeous,
you know, all these amazing like broke details.
I love the pool sequence with Reese and Ryan. Like that whole like location looks like it's out of like a fucking Newport mansion or something.
Yeah. So the Blu-ray does have a couple deleted scenes. I only watched one of them because it was Catherine goes to war with Sebastian, and I was like, let's see what that is. So basically, the scene when she's like, my triumph is over you, blah 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 blah. So there's a really famous line from the original that's where it's like he's like, if you don't fuck me, like this is a declaration of war, and she's like, war it is. They had that in this movie. The problem was basically she says something to him and he hits her. And then she goes on the ground and she's like, motherfucker. And he gets on top of her and it's kind of rapey.
Yeah.
But then he's like, I will get off of you if you stop. Like, just stop. And he gets up and he apologizes and he's like, get on that bed and prepare for the fuck of a lifetime. Otherwise, I will consider it a declaration of war. And he's like, one, two, and she goes, three, war it is. And Cumble goes, yeah, we cut it because we just thought that if he hit her, the audience would not be on his side anymore.
Yeah.
But he was I was really bummed because I wanted that line, which is the iconic line from the original, but we couldn't have it because we had him hit her.
Yeah. Mm. I think that that was probably a good decision. Yes. In that, like, what sort of makes this film, even though, you know, it's aged in certain ways better than others, but what makes this film still, like, a total classic is that, like, it does feel very fun still. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that that is, like, a step too far, like, in terms of how serious they are about fucking each other.
Like, mm-hmm. even if you have it, like, because it is, like, a satire and, like, it is walking that camp funny line, I think there are certain elements and things that even if it's a funny, like, satire movie, that it's, like, hard to sell. Like, I watched last night Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, and, like, in it, Steve Martin's character, like, hits a woman. And even though it's, like, satirizing noirs and how in so many noirs, like, men are constantly, like, hitting women, and it's, like, played really much, like, as a bit, and, like, you know it's a bit, and they're selling it as a bit, it's still hard to watch, and you're immediately, like, I don't, like, I know you're trying to, like, comment on it, but even by commenting on it, it still just feels cringy, and I don't think, and it's, like, really a fucking daft move that they took that out, because I think it, I don't know if it would have sold it, well.
It's interesting, though, that we're saying that, though. We're saying, okay, I mean, and I'm not, like, critiquing any of us here, but I think it's all in the way it's presented, but it's, like, okay, we're saying, okay, him hitting her is drawing the line, which, granted, the hitting is presented seriously, like, it's not, playing for laughs. In a movie where a teenager is blackmailed into having sex with a guy.
Yeah.
Right.
It's, and I mean, I don't know if we call it sexual assault or not, like, blah, 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 but it's, when he first eats her out, like, it's presented in a way that's funny because she does that thing where she's like, oh!
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's definitely, like, I think that it really comes down to, like, cinematic language where there are some things on screen that will just, no matter what, register as, like, oh my god, no. Like, don't do that. And I think, like, a slap is one of them for whatever reason.
I think it also depends on where it takes place in the film, right? Yeah. Like, a lot of the more reprehensible stuff is front-loaded, so it's okay to hate Sebastian at that point.
Yes.
And then when we're supposed to be really invested in him and the net, that's when they start to really parse back, and it just becomes Catherine doing all the bad shit.
Right.
Because we can still hate her.
Yeah. And for what it's worth, the most boring part of the movie is when Ryan and Reese are in love.
Oh, my God.
Like,
it's such a snooze fest.
20 minutes where I'm just checked out.
That's right. It's like those last 20, you're like, ah.
No, but I totally disagree with you about the ending, which we'll get to in a little bit.
No, that's the ending I'm talking about. Like, I like the last scene where Reese, like, the find out.
So you're saying it like it whiffs the third act.
Yes. Like, I think the third act is, like, messy because you're just like, I don't know if I buy into their relationship because I'm just like,
I'm just bored. I will argue that I do buy into their relationship only because I think that the retirement home scene, which I love the...
that's the best scene with them, like, between the two.
But when they're driving home and she does the stupid faces, like, honestly, like, that's the scene that sells me on them. That's the scene that makes it work.
I feel like because the ending scene is so iconic, we need to touch on it. I mean, okay, listen, there's a lot of good needle drops in life, but... Bittersweet Symphony.
I listened to this soundtrack endlessly after this movie came out. Like, this whole soundtrack is actually really, really good.
Yes.
I would argue that this is the least, like, it's my least favorite song, but it could just be because it became so pervasive after this movie.
I think it works better when it's paired with the visuals of the film. So, like, literally, when I hear this song, I only see the end of this film. I cannot
agree more.
I don't think or see anything else. It's just... I'm playing the ending of Cruel Intentions in my brain. Like, that is what I'm doing when I hear this.
Well, that's the power of a good needle drop, is that, like, it makes it pairs the song and the visuals in a way that, like, elevates both of them. Like, I don't think that the ending scene
cements it in your mind.
Yeah, I don't think the ending scene hits with, like, the absolutely insane melodrama that you want it to, unless you have this, like, big operatic, like, violin business playing over it. And similarly, like, the song is
iconic,
but I also wouldn't put it really high on the list, but it works perfectly for this scene because it's just ridiculous. I love it. Everything goes to slow motion, the students slowly shaking their heads at her, it's perfect.
It's actually very reminiscent of Jawbreaker in that regard, right? Where, like, we're going to turn everybody so that they can identify who's been behind all of this bad shit, go to slow-mo, play a big song, peace out.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a good music video.
Yeah, I mean, right. I even love the encounter between her and Annette in the bathroom, like, before we get the song. Like, again, like, I mean, we don't get any Catherine Annette in this movie except for this one scene. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where I'm like, oh, like, I would love to just see Annette, like, full-on confront her. But,
yeah,
nope, Cecile will do that while Annette drives off into the sunset in this Jaguar.
But that's when you realize that they makes so much
more sense. Like,
oh, I don't think... for sure.
It'd be out of character for Annette to go big like that. So I like the fact that she plays it cool because she knows she's already got her plan in motion, which is a very Catherine thing to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She like we said, she's very smart. She knows what she's about. I mean, she throws Catherine's own line back at her about like turning to Jesus in her time of need, which she didn't even hear. So she must have gotten it secondhand from Cecile. Or the screenwriters were like, whatever, it's all the same.
Yeah, I think she got it from the journal.
Probably.
Oh, from the journal.
Oh yeah,
there we go.
Yeah, because he drew the rosary like around her picture.
Yes.
I will say too, actually, I mean, again, out of all the versions of this, this is the best end for this character. Although the Dangerous Liaisons one is great, Glenn Close goes to the opera and she is literally booed out of the opera house and runs home. Amazing. And just like she's alone and she's crying and she just wipes off her makeup and the film just like fades to black as she just looks a fucking mess wiping off her makeup.
I mean, iconic.
I like that.
Yes.
Like
melodrama.
Nothing better than an opera scene, let me tell you.
Yeah. But I like that it's sort of, it's still, you know, the funeral is in this like very grand space. It's very performance forward. And it really is like the all eyes on me thing.
It always made me curious. Hey, so like, people are leaving, like, you know, and she seems to be the only one that cares that people are leaving. My issue is always like, okay, there's adults in this room that don't know this journal is being passed out. They have not read the journal yet. So no one except for Catherine is being like, what the fuck are y'all doing?
Yes.
Yeah, and I feel like it's very interesting because she is, like, ostensibly the one with the good reputation and Sebastian is the one with, like, the bad reputation. Like, everyone knows that he likes to sleep around, but nobody knows that she's, like, a secret manipulative coke addict. And so I think that, obviously, I don't think that the movie is putting too fine of a point on this, but I like, just sort of, like, interpretation-wise, the idea that, like, it's like she says earlier in the movie, he can fuck around and sleep with whoever he wants and like he's more or less forgiven for it and he still gets a packed house at his funeral, but like she is not allowed the same freedom. And like the fact that she gets like exposed at the end is seen as this like victory for the good female characters of the film, but at the same time it's like, is what she's doing significantly worse than
that's fair
fucking around with women like all the time?
I'm curious because I always feel like the interpretation that I have of this end is that she's being blamed for Sebastian's death. And they actually make that explicit in the TV pilot where his dad blames Annette and her for being the ones who like got his son killed. And you're just like, Sebastian was his own person. He had agency, clearly, because he was fucking around and doing a lot of scandalous shit.
Yeah.
And it feels like everybody then just wants to blame the two women, which I think is a very odd, I mean, it's a very 1999 thing to do.
I mean, I don't get blaming Annette. I mean, because he could have just let her die, like whatever, like let the car hit her. She probably would have bounced back. But
she probably would have stopped the car.
Like, technically,
she furrows her brow.
It is literally Ronald's fault, but it is indirectly Catherine's fault because, again, had none of this happened, had she not instigated the bet, this wouldn't have happened at all.
Right.
Yeah.
And she calls Ronald and is like, hey, did you know that he fucks Cecile? But also, like, Ronald, she's in your bed.
Well, I was going to say, in like, light of the deleted scene, it's interesting because, like, on the phone, she's like, Sebastian hit me.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, she's lying.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that, but you're right. No, because in the final cut, we're like, oh, she's making this up.
Right.
So
yes.
She lies and says Sebastian hit her, but in the original cut, it was true.
He actually hit her.
And it gives you sympathy for her, which doesn't work. Okay.
Yeah. So interesting.
While we're on the Ronald and Sarah, can we talk about when she pulls like the drawer out
or whatever,
and he's under the bed? The most iconic thing ever, places to hide.
With his little fuzzy handcuffs. Yeah.
I do find it very weird.
It's weird as fuck, but it's like, in terms of like, if you're a high schooler and like you're gonna get caught having sex, like
trying to hide your man. Well, so,
right, if you're like hiding in a drawer.
He's not a high schooler, is he?
No.
I don't think so.
That is the other thing with this relationship with him and Cecile, where it's like, he's
statutory
also
rape.
It's statutory rape. Like, 100. Yeah. The scene when she like does the little headstand and like her vagina is like full on in his face. I mean, yeah, it's just a little
like,
weird.
What, 20s?
Yeah,
right?
They don't. Yeah. I think probably smartly they don't really specify it, except for the fact that he is like instructing her, but he doesn't go to the same school as them. No. Right. So,
but I don't think he's in school.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks like a grad to me.
I mean,
he lives on 59th and Park or whatever.
Yeah,
good for him.
He could be with his family.
Yes. I think that he, like we said, he gets away relatively unscathed. So at least like. That's a plus, and that he isn't blamed for Sebastian's death. Like, he just is there and then disappears.
I mean, pilot aside, that we know. Watching this last night, I was like, oh, he's going to jail.
Mm-hmm. It's at least manslaughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, and also, we should be blaming that cab driver, too. Watch where you're going. There's a full man.
He was not paying attention. Like, he literally was like,
he wasn't even texting. That's the funny part. It's like, dude, what are you doing with your eyes right now?
No, honestly, my biggest thing with that whole kill scene is like, okay, I don't know if y'all been to New York, but Central Park is very large. And the fact that the Annette, Ronald, and Valmont all end up
on the one street also, too. Because, like, in Central Park, it's like there's a road that goes through, but, like, there's so much other space that you can be that's not on a road. Like, it could be a biker that hits them. A runner.
He's gotta die.
Sure.
You know,
it's pretty weak. I wish that they would have thought of a different way to have a confrontation that could end in an accidental murder.
This
just kind of feels half cooked to me.
Yeah,
what's the modern version of a duel? Getting run over by a car, apparently.
Right?
Yeah, I think it would have been interesting if it was like a full on like pistols at dawn, but like, you know, we're just gonna meet up and fight about it.
Paintball
we're
gun?
Gonna meet at the fencing club, but I swapped out my fencing sword with a real sword and stabbed you.
Hey,
not a bad idea, actually. Yes. Not a bad idea. Actually, that's fine. Do that.
Rules. I like that. I'm sold.
They seem like the type of people that would fence. I mean, you know, Ryan Phillippe has that amazing, like, all-white tennis outfit. All you got to do is swap that for a fencing outfit, set up, pay off, you plant the seed.
Lovely.
All right. Hey, maybe in the TV series, that's what they'll make happen.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
I feel like the show should have been on, like, HBO or a streamer where they can just go full tilt, like,
it's
going to
be on the like, actual reboot that's, like, happening is going to be on Amazon.
Oh, so there's another reboot, too?
No, there's, like, an actual,
But it's unrelated to this, though.
It's unrelated.
Got it.
But here's the thing. I don't know why this pilot didn't get picked up for NBC, because again,
it's shocker.
Maybe it's one of those things where it's like the pilots they did have were just better than this, but like,
I think so.
I spent years being like, well, it must have been a huge piece of shit, and it's not. So I just like, it's one of those where I'm like, the hook is there. Like, I don't know.
I wonder if the sex is what turned people off.
America, we are, as a country, fucking scared of sex, but we love violence, so I'm sure that was part of it. Because for some reason, people don't understand that sex is fine. It's so fucking annoying.
Yes. Like, maybe I don't have enough of a breath of, like, what is actually being shown on NBC, but if I saw someone, like,
are you not watching
Major
Network TV anymore?
On NBC, I'd be like, this is the wrong network for
But
this,
at the same time with NBC, you're like, though, but it's like, did y'all watch the movie first before you said yes to this
pilot? Right. Yeah, like, you should know what you're getting yourself into.
Actually is one of the things that I think, as scandalous as this film actually is, one of the things that I take away from it is that it's surprisingly sex positive. It's hey, be careful about the sex that you're having, but nobody ends up getting shamed for actually wanting to have sex or being sexual.
It's just who
I really like that.
Yeah,
agreed.
And I like that there's sort of like an acknowledgement too that like sleeping with a certain number of people like will shame you, but like it's society's problem, it's not your problem. Mm-hmm. Like that's the whole idea with like Cecile/Selma Blair is like, if we can deflower her, like her reputation will be ruined, but like it's not our fault that her reputation will get ruined. That's just like how it is.
I mean also on network TV you couldn't get Sarah Michelle Gellar saying pussy whipped, and for that, like, obviously maybe that's why they didn't take it up, because that was some of the most iconic deliveries of all time.
She has all the good lines in this.
She has the best lines.
Explicit queerness in the film aside, Sarah Michelle, Ryan Phillippe's ass and Sarah Michelle Gellar's everything are why this film has a huge queer following. Like, gay men worship at the altar of Catherine Martoil.
As we all should.
100%.
I mean, it's like that kiss scene. I know, like, of course, it's like, oh, a cultural reset, like, made so many women realize they were queer. But, like, it is, like, it famously won Best Kiss at the MTV Movie Awards.
Brooke, we need to talk about this.
Are you going
to
tell me what else it was up against?
Oh, no. I was going to just mention the MTV Awards. It won for, nominated for Best Kiss with Sarah and Selma. Did not win.
Wait, they didn't win?
No, they won.
They won.
Oh, wait, no, they did win. Sorry, they did win that.
One of the most famous wins ever. Okay.
What they were nommed for was in the Teen Choice Awards for Hissy Fit and Sleazebag, two categories that no longer exist.
I was going to say, those sound novel and new.
Interestingly enough, though, the Kiss one, Sarah Michelle Gellar was nominated for Best Villain and lost, but she was also nominated for Best Female Performance and won.
There we go.
Good for her.
But now I want to know why?
Because she's not a true villain.
Yeah.
She's just someone we can root for.
She's sympathetic.
I mean, like, with the Kiss, though, it is, like, as we were saying earlier, like, this, at the time of filming and everything, like, meant we were, the studio and film industry is very much focused on, like, teen boys. Like, you could definitely see how the Kiss was kind of pandering to heterosexual boys and
Jordan,
being like, look at this shit.
I'm not suggesting that
I don't think you were. I just think we need
women.
To mention that because it's so clearly like of the moment be like, hey boys, you want to see some girls
smooch. It's very male gaze.
I'm sorry. I have to play a game with y'all because I have to read this best
we love games.
List.
Okay.
So 1999, I'm sorry, the 2000 MTV Movie Awards nominees for Best Villain, and I want y'all to tell me who wins.
Okay.
We've got Mike Myers as Dr. Evil in Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. We've got Matt Damon as Tom Ripley in The Talented Mr. Ripley.
He should win.
Sarah Michelle Gellar in this.
Funny.
Ray Park as Darth Maul in Star Wars Episode One, and Christopher Walken as the Headless Horseman in Sleepy Hollow.
Wow! Again, 1999 year of bangers.
That is
I'm gonna say that either Ray Park or
pick one. You have to pick one.
Okay. Ray Park, just because Star Wars was so big.
I am gonna say Matt Damon.
Okay, and Trace, sorry, what was the first one?
Mike Myers from Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Fuck.
So that's what I'm guessing.
Fuck.
Yes. Mike Myers won Best Villain. Both for the first and second Austin Powers as Dr. Evil 2 years apart.
You know what? The teens are not okay because
MTV.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Come on.
You know, I'm going to say that not enough people saw this movie. Way more people saw Austin Powers than saw Cruel Intentions.
Yeah.
Oh, that sequel? That sequel made more than $200 million. So
much money.
Absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, all those movies are bangers, though. Like, no notes. Great. All good performances.
1999 was a very good year.
Sleepy Hollow, masterpiece.
We'll always have Best Kiss. And I mean,
the best female performance that Sarah Michelle Gellar won, she beat Neve Campbell for Scream 3, Drew Barrymore for Never Been Kissed, Julia Roberts for Runaway Bride, and Ashley Judd for Double Jeopardy.
Okay, wow.
That is a strong category.
Yeah,
strong category, but she should have won of all those. Scream 3, the weakest of the series, is my take.
Well, and also the least memorable of Neve Campbell's performances, because she's not in the movie.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad that we all... Well, because I've on Twitter, there has been, like, a weird resurgence of people being like, Scream 3 is actually a masterpiece? And I'm like, not really,
Scream 4 is fine.
Joe, you'll be happy.
Yes, agreed.
Neve Campbell won Best Female Performance for Scream 2.
Yes!
The best one.
Good for her.
Great film, a great performance. I want to do... I'll do a Scream marathon before the new one comes out.
Oh, 100%. I've watched Scream 4 once a month this year. Like, I've watched it 10 times.
Good, perfect movie. I watched them all in a row in like 2 days last year, and it was like the happiest I've been.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Scream 4 is so fucking good.
Yes. I'm very excited.
What happened to her, Hayden?
Hayden Panettiere.
Yeah.
After starring in Bring It On. I think she's in some... Isn't she on Nashville?
That show's
was.
Like...
She was on Nashville for a long time. Yeah. I think she...
But that ate up
she
like a
fallen into the
time.
Hallmark holiday movie?
That would make
like
sense.
Seems like somewhere she should be.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Wow.
I don't know. Maybe she'll have a comeback.
Maybe her she'll be in this.
Her and Sarah Michelle Gellar. I don't know.
I'm very... Yeah. Who knows?
I will say that this film was a surprise hit, which is very exciting considering it was made for nothing. It opened at number 2 at the box office behind Analyze This. Analyze That in March of 1999. It opened super wide. Yes. What were you going to look at?
It opened super wide. Oof. Honestly, Brooke. This is
a G-rated podcast. Nice.
You know, I've said that a million times and I've never really processed it, and now I can never say it again.
There are some bangers, though, in this box office, just like looking at it. You got Shakespeare in Love. You've got She's All That, Blast from the Past, Saving Private Ryan, Rushmore, Office Space, Elizabeth.
Blast
from the Past is a bop. It's so fun.
We love every Brendan Fraser property.
Yes.
On this podcast.
I just rewatched 10 Cloverfield Lane with some friends last week, and they were like, oh, it's like Blast from the Past. And I was like, yeah, but not fun. funny.
No, very little laughs in that one.
Speaking of resurgences, we're having a major Brendan Fraser resurgence.
That's true.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
It makes me so happy.
I am too.
This opened super wide in 2,300 theaters. And let's see. Let me look at the original budget for this bad boy. This was made for a budget of $11 million. Thank you very much. And it made $76 million worldwide. $38 million domestic. That's a win. I'm very happy. Good for them. People want to see people fuck.
It doesn't sound like, I mean, $38 million doesn't sound like a lot. But again, yeah, up against an $11 million budget, it's like, and honestly,
it's a good profit.
I think this is, it was a hit when it came out, obviously. But I think this is one of those ones where it played on whatever cable channel. Yes. And a bunch of kids who could not see it were like, oh, we grew up on this on TV.
100%.
And it it handily made back its money and then made back its like cultural significance in like following years. Like it's a win. Yeah.
I mean, the reason I watched this movie is because my roommate at the time was like, you haven't seen Cruel Intentions. And I was like, no. And she was like, well, cool. That's what we're doing tonight. And I was like,
and
oh,
then you
okay,
were like,
great.
Eh, it's not that good.
I was like, I have some notes on this movie, actually.
Yeah, hell yeah. Is there anything else that we forgot to mention that we absolutely must talk about? I think we did a pretty good job.
The tangents were real.
Oh, but you've got to have that's all we do. It's essential. Jordan, would you like to guess the average Letterboxd rating?
I would.
Okay. Trace, as we mentioned off mic, you are not allowed to participate. But Joe, if you would like to put in a guess,
okay,
please
this
feel
is
free.
At a five, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Just realistically, I think like there are people who are going to be like a fat five no matter what. I think there are going to be people who give it like a 1.5. And then there's going to be the me who gives it like a 3 or 3.5.
Too
because
low.
I don't know if it's a masterpiece or what.
You're wrong.
So I'm going to say.
You're wrong. Sorry.
Three one.
Is that your final
three,
answer?
3-1. Yes.
Okay. Joe, would you like to put in a guess?
I'm going to guess 2.8 because, yes, Americans do hate
sex. I think it has to be a little better than a 2.
It is a 3.2. Mm-hmm. So you guys were pretty close. And unfortunately, Jordan, you were right. A lot of people giving this 3, 3.5, 2.5 stars. Yeah. Once again, too low.
I looked at it yesterday and I was like, that person's not my friend anymore.
I was going to say, you have to be so careful. With Trace, he will literally unfriend you if you say the wrong thing about certain movies.
Chase, I'm raising mine to a 5 now.
No, we covered Clue on the podcast recently and we had someone comment and then they were like, this movie is so annoying to me. And I was like, you know what? Everyone can have their own opinion. I totally get it. Whatever. It's a deal breaker movie where I'm like, if you don't find Clue funny, we are not going to gel as human beings because we are so clearly different in everything, shape, way, or form. Like,
no better gag than the Candy Graham gag. That is the perfect joke.
Yes!
It's the perfect joke.
Yes. We have covered Clue on this podcast, and I love it. I think you
I had to turn
around. Come around.
It was the first time I watched it. I was like, I don't get this humor. It was a couple years ago. And then I rewatched it and I was like, oh, this is actually good.
Yeah. It's very smart.
It's a great movie. I love that movie.
Clue actually also plays really well. I watched it with subtitles for the first time. It plays really well with subtitles because you can read all the wordplay and all the puns.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. I feel
it's
like this
so
movie
true.
Probably too.
Yes. Yeah. I think that like, it's sometimes it does like read very differently than like hearing things said. That's why this is like, I'll make it a really quick tangent, but I always watch Westerns with the titles on because like Western like speak is so interesting, but you can never fucking understand what they're saying because everyone is mumbling. So I recommend if anyone is watching Westerns, I recently watched The Harder They Fall on Netflix. You should throw the subtitles on.
I was literally
just going to
say, you should probably put the subtitles on for that.
You should
because
you literally can't understand what anybody's saying.
Yup. Sorry.
Whatever. It's fine. Okay.
Queer Quadrant, where's it landing?
How are we feeling? Okay. I would say, and this is like how gay I feel that it is, not necessarily reflecting the quality rating
of the film.
But I would say between Ryan Phillippe's ass and Christine Baranski and the kiss scene that has been reclaimed by queer women everywhere, even if that wasn't the original intended audience, I'm going to give it a nice solid down the middle 3 stars.
I love it.
How about you? What do you think?
For being a queer podcast and being all queer, you know, people, it's so funny that we didn't, well, we kind of touched on, but I feel like the majority of our talk was not about the two actually gay people in the movie.
They're not that interesting. They're only in one scene, exactly.
Right. Where it's like, there is like a gay relationship happening and like there are gay characters, which is cool. But as we also mentioned, it's kind of like tertiary and they're kind of shunted upon and get jokes kind of thrown at them. And while Blaine has some autonomy, it is very much like, we'll like give a checkbox.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, so I'll go with 3-2.
Hey, look at that. Trace, what do you think?
So I agree with what y'all are saying, what, like, full stop about the queer characters in the film, but I think what we're overlooking here, though, is the impact this film has had on the queer community and how it's been adopted by the queer community.
Yeah.
So while the portrayals of queerness may not be, like, the best or most fleshed out, although I would argue that for 1999, they're actually pretty okay. Yeah.
Could be a lot worse. Yeah,
it could be a lot worse. It could be better, but honestly, I mean, like, if you weren't doing indie films, like, you weren't going to be having, like, these really fleshed out queer characters for the most part. So, in terms of the place this film has in, like, queer film, queer cinema pantheon, I'm giving it a 4.
Love.
Can I
mean, the movie itself is a 5 out of 5 for me, but, like, yeah, if we're grading on a queer scale...
Can I raise to a 3.5?
You go for
it. I'm raising to a 3.5. It feels more comfortable as a 3.5, as we were saying, like, just with, as I was saying that we didn't talk about Blaine, I was like convincing myself, just because I think it has it, it's like, it's text. Like, it's not like we're pulling like strings anywhere.
But we love,
you know,
subtext,
I mean?
As well.
Oh, we love subtext. Oh, we thrive on subtext.
And cultural cachet.
We have to.
Cachet.
As queer people, we have to thrive on subtext.
Absolutely. That's all we get usually.
Yes. Joe, how about you?
So I'm going to agree with Jordan. I'm going to say 3.5, not because I disagree with Trace, because I do think it's had a huge cultural impact. I think for me, yeah, it's threading that tricky line between, is it good representation? Is it representation for representation's sake?
Right.
I think for me, the reason it comes in strong at a 3.5 is also because of the camp. And
yeah,
that's something that I feel like it's so specifically catered to queer people in that regard. Like, we just see and appreciate camp in a completely different sense. And it's not just like, oh, we love a bitchy woman or we love a sassy gay. It's, I don't know, it's that sweet spot that just works better for us. And I think a lot of the dialogue in particular in this film is like very queer.
Yes.
I mean, the whole first half, I would say, arguably, is like really like such elevated camp, and like the way that like they're playing, like you're talking about, even like the first scene, like, is so
amazing,
snappy. Yes. And it just feels like something that you would see play like a rep theater with like a queer director or something, like introducing it and being like, this is the movie that like inspired me to do X, Y, or Z. I mean, Demi Lovato came out and was like, this is the movie that made me gay or whatever. Like, there are so many people who say that. So it's like,
also
great.
The Susie Kurtz role would have to be played by a drag queen.
Of course.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My God.
Telling you.
That would rule.
Amazon needs to listen to this episode because we just have ideas on
Just don't fuck it up.
I know. We can showrun for you.
I really want to see the fucking
musical. That's the problem. They're going to make it too serious, and it's not going to work. They need to make it campy.
But it's also, I mean, we know it's not related to the film, but again, like, I mean, like, I'm going to tell any fans of this film right here, when you're going into this TV show, whenever the fuck it comes out, like, it's going to be just like I Know What You Did Last Summer, where it's like, you better have no preconceived... Yeah, you better not have, oh, I hope they do this from the movie in this show. No. Get rid of that. It's going to be its own thing with the name Cruel Intentions. That's all it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where we've hit in terms of IP. Yeah. And I'll be interested to see
it. It's
how
so
that
exciting.
Continues to devolve over the next
year.
Well,
my thing. That was, my, I guess, my big point that I didn't say when I brought up that question earlier is, like, I understand us, like, and I really love, like, Sarah Michelle and all these people getting their stardom and whatever, like, old stars. That's great. But also, it's just, like, our, like, relentless need for IP is so soul-crushing at this point, where it's just, like...
I have seen people over and over again, like, do very cool things with it, though, which is, like, the only thing that's keeping
totally,
me, like, moving towards
there
the
is
light.
Some good... Yeah.
Yeah.
For every bad, there's a good.
Yeah.
It's whenever we talk about remakes, we're like, look... Joe and I are very pro remake. We're like, look, you can take something and do something different. And just mean, if it's a good movie, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And yeah, there have been a lot of shitty remakes, but there's also been a lot of really good remakes. Regardless of whether or not they're better than the original or not, you can have a remake that's good that's not better than the original.
Yeah.
Joe, Trace, thank you so much for being here. Such a delight. Loved having you. And oh my God, of course. And you you guys are great and have a lot of great stuff going on. So if people would like to find you, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me anywhere at Trace Thurman, Trace D as in dog, Thurman, my first name, last name. And you can find the podcast at Horror Queers everywhere. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Bloody Disgusting. That's our podcast network. So go find us there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can be found at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B. And you should really follow me instead of Trace because I have fewer followers.
So we got to even the playing field.
He also occasionally posts pictures of him in a Speedo.
Oh, extra.
There it is.
God, it was like three times.
And just to plug that, Horror Queers is the best. And if you're not listening to it, you should be, especially with the Chucky recaps, which are currently happening as of
this
recording.
That show is so fun.
It's so good.
Much fun. Need to start it.
Yes. Jordan has so many more followers than me, and I'm never going to catch up. So I've just given up. But maybe one day the gap will close a little more. But I don't think I'll ever catch you.
The reason is because I was too online growing up.
Yeah, and I was not online at all.
Desensitized to everything. So honestly, your mental health is probably in such a better place because of it.
Well, I'm terrible. I'm terrible at Twitter, and you're pretty good at Twitter, but like at what cost, you know? At what
cost of living alone forever?
I have to force myself to tweet.
Who runs your show's Twitter account, or do y'all split it evenly?
It's probably both of us.
Us, Joe is like 90% of our Twitter. I would argue maybe even 95% of our Twitter account.
Yeah, which is super impressive that I've grown it past my own Twitter account. I'm just like, what the fuck, people?
Like, what am I doing?
Yeah,
you'll just change it to your name. Just swap your usernames on each one.
Nobody ever needs to know.
That would rule.
Well,
that, fuckers.
That's like what a cranky like PR person or whatever does on like a major like company. Like they get fired and they just change the name like at Amazon to theirs, and they like run the Amazon as their personal.
You're good. You're out of there. Yes. Well, if you want to add some fuel to whatever this fire is,
cruel and fire.
Yes, you can also find us on Twitter. I'm a Brooke B. Solomon.
I'm Jordan H. Gus,
and we're together at Queer Quadrant. And you can find this podcast also everywhere: Apple, Spotify, wherever you get it. Drop us a rate. Drop us a review. Drop us a subscribe.
Drop us a journal.
Yes, give us your best burn books. This was the prototypical burn book. I think we can all agree. And you can also tweet at us. Tell us what you think about this iconic film and your hopes for the series, and maybe what you want to see us cover in the future,
which will be
So next week we are taking a trip to Symmetry Land and talking about Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel, a very different type of potentially queer subtext.
Also
movie.
Sassy, though.
Very sassy.
A lot of great one-liners.
I'm very excited.
Masterpiece will be my fourth time watching it this year.
It might be the only time we'll cover Wes Anderson on the podcast.
False.
So
false.
I know you want to cover The French Dispatch, but I don't know.
There are probably others.
I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, tune in while you can get some Wes Anderson. Just know that's actually happening, and that will be next week. So come back for that.
Check in, one was said.
Check into the Grand Budapest.
And Brooke, do you have anything you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. I'm very busy on Etsy buying a Coke crucifix.
Fuck.